U.S. trade with China has grown a lot in recent decades. It has brought lower prices for American consumers and big opportunities for U.S. businesses in China's vast market. From the opposite perspective, the United States has emerged as the top export destination for Chinese products. But since 2018, this once friendly relationship has turned into a trade war. I'm Katerina Vutsina, a journalist at IMED. I talked to Mr. Konstantinos Tsimonis, senior lecturer in Chinese studies at King's College London and academic lead of the China program at the Institute of International Relations at Pantheon University. We discussed the intricate dynamics of the U.S.-China trade conflict and whether we are witnessing a new Cold War. What is next for China's Belt and Road Initiative? And how do factors like the South China Sea crisis, Taiwan's strategic importance, and TikTok play into this ongoing conflict? Mr. Tsimonis, hi and welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure.
So let's set the stage for this discussion. U.S.-China trade war. I just want to ask you to describe China as a business power. How does it compare to the U.S. and how has its role evolved over the past 20 years?
So China today is the second biggest economy. The U.S. remains the biggest economy, especially in per capita terms. When it comes to national GDP, China is closing in. So, and there are predictions that it will very soon surpass the U.S. And we could say, of course, that it is a problem that right now we have the two biggest economies, that we have the two biggest economies upon which global capitalism thrives, to be in such a state of relations. Now, how has China's role evolved since joining the WTO? China joined the WTO in late 2001. And that was definitely a watershed for the world economy, but also for China itself. The WTO introduced very positive changes in the Chinese economy. So we have more transparency from ministries. There are better laws that protect competition. We have had different protections being removed. And overall, because of the entering WTO, we have a way more secure environment for foreign investors and for local businesses. All these contributed in the miracle of the 2000s. So from 2001 to 2010-11, China had many consecutive years of double-digit growth. Having said that, the Chinese economic model is quite different to that of the US or Europe. It has been described as state capitalism. State capitalism refers to the dominant, the controlling role of the state within the economy. Now, this is achieved through the state-owned enterprises, which dominate certain sectors, for example, energy, resource extraction, finance, telecommunications. If we see the structure of the Chinese economy, we will notice that 60% of it is private and 40% is state control. However, because of the role of state-owned enterprises, the reach of the state extends to the entire economy. It doesn't matter, for instance, if you have lots of private companies in a certain sector, but then in the middle of that sector, you have a state-owned enterprises that has immense influence in how that economic activity is organized. So this model, although it has benefited from global capitalism, it has benefited from the entry to WTO, and it has resulted to China becoming the second biggest economic power today, it is a very different model from the capitalist models we know in the West.
And we are now speaking about a trade war between the US and China. But I was wondering, how did that start? What ignited it? And What are the dynamics now? Can we speak for a new Cold War in a way?
So it was ignited by Trump in 2018, as you very well know, who set tariffs on many Chinese products. But of course, there are underlying reasons, economic and geopolitical, for the trade war. So yes, Trump was the one who started it. However, the reasons for this trade war were there already for many decades. Now, the first key issue are, of course, trade imbalances. So China has benefited through, when it comes to global trade, it has followed a very carefully designed strategy of technology transfer. Many Western companies, they moved their operations to China exactly because they thought they would be more profitable, but then they saw their products basically being copied by Chinese competitors. So this issue of knowledge transfer has resulted in a situation where we have widening trade imbalances between China and the US, China and Europe, and every single European country, and of course every other country. So in many policy circles in the US and in Europe, there was this apprehension about what does this mean for the future of our economic relations. Is that sustainable? Is it sustainable to basically buy everything from China? And the answer was no. Apart from the trade imbalance issue, there are also geopolitical, very important geopolitical dimensions. And the fact is that with the current Chinese leadership, so Xi Jinping, we have seen a way more assertive China when it comes to diplomatic, political, and strategic issues. So China is really building up its army. It has unilaterally created military bases in the South China Sea. It is provoking its neighbors, Japan and Taiwan, of course. So we see that in the last decade or so under Xi Jinping, those who were for many decades were worrying about a China threat, about the rise of China, they seem to be justified, at least to a certain degree. We see a way more assertive, a way more confident China that wants to dominate its periphery and expand its interests globally. Are we looking at the Cold War? I think the issue here is not to think in terms of a replication of the Cold War we experienced between the US and the Soviet Union, but to discuss whether we're looking at a new type of a Cold War, an extremely complicated relation between the two main powers, and the likelihood that in both Washington and Beijing, those who are advocating in favor of decoupling or in favor of a more confrontational approach, in the end of the day, will dominate.
Speaking about the expansion of China, what do you think is the future of Chinese business expansion globally, especially 10 years into the Belt and Road Initiative, China's international investment scheme? And to give a local example here in Greece, we have the port of Piraeus, which is often referred as Dragon's Head, just because it's located strategically on the route between the Suez Canal and Gibraltar, the shipping route, I mean, and there, of course, it connects with railways, Greece to Central and Eastern Europe.
Well, the Belt and Road Initiative, in many ways, started before China conceived the name of the Belt and Road Initiative, right? So as you've very correctly pointed out, in the case of Piraeus, China and Piraeus, which is considered to be a key BRI project, actually the first investment was in 2009, so 3 or 4 years before the BRI was announced. So this shows that something was happening already. And that something is the expansion of global, the global expansion of Chinese business interests. So this was happening already in the early 2000s, but especially after the 2008 financial crisis that hit the West really hard, and of course Greece as well, with 2 years delay, China found itself in a situation that could use its money to shop around, literally, to shop around infrastructure, energy, resources, and really gain a foothold in all the different important sectors of different countries. It was the byproduct of a strategy of expansion. Then we have the opportunity of 2008. And then with the BRI, essentially the state comes in and says, well, we can speed up the rise of China by helping state-owned enterprises and Chinese private enterprises in acquiring market share. And we will do that because we are in need of access to energy resources, because we have industrial overcapacity. And what does this mean? It means basically that we have companies that can build roads and railways, but we don't have any more roads and railways to build within China. So these companies need to go abroad and capture market share in other parts of the world. So as a result, in the beginning, there was a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of money spent left and right. The model was essentially state-owned enterprises were lobbying politicians in China and also state banks to gain diplomatic support and financial support for certain projects. And this created opportunities, many opportunities for trade. Now, overall, China has now committed around $1 trillion, I think, US dollars in different projects. That's massive amount of money. And the truth is that this money is needed because, especially in the developing part of the world economy, in the developing countries of the world economy, there is a massive gap when it comes to infrastructure needs. This gap was calculated around 6 or 7 trillion US dollars that need to be spent. China is coming to cover a big part of it. And of course, this will have, and also has now, political and diplomatic gains. Having said that, following the pandemic, we see that China is slowing down its investments. And I think that's wise, because we have had lots of investments that didn't produce the expected results. We have many cases of corruption, many cases of investments turning no profits and creating actually political and diplomatic problems for China. I believe that the BRI is here to stay, yes, but we will see a more prudent BRI developing, and I think that's a good thing for the world economy as well.
So in light of another recent world crisis, which is the war in Ukraine, can you explain the Chinese-Russian relations, and also as we can describe it as a triangle, the US-Chinese-Russian relations?
Yes, I have 2 points on this topic. For the first one is that as a result of the Russian invasion in Ukraine, we see that Russia has become very dependent on China. If it wasn't for China, the Russian economy would be dead by now. And China has now leveraged, has been pressuring for Russia to lower the price of gas. It basically exports all its electronics to Russia. So in a peculiar way, although in the Cold War we had Russia as the big brother and China as the small brother, now this has been reversed. And China right now has way more influence on Russia than the other way around. The only exception to that is military technology. That's something that Russia is still still has a very robust industry and still exports a lot of its technology to China. But China is doing again this technology transfer kind of is following this technology transfer kind of strategy and building on its own military technologies. And many of them actually are copies of the Russian technology. Now, when it comes to the triangle, well, using Kissinger's wisdom here, the triangle relations is very important in terms of the West, the US primarily, but also the West controlling Russia. That is, at least in my view, that the biggest problem that the West is facing. We have a very politically unstable or country that is ruled by unstable politicians that is has thousands of nuclear weapons. And this is a permanent security problem for Europe and for the from a Euro-Atlantic perspective. Now, whether we like it or not, the West needs some sort of a deal with China to rebalance this triangle, as it pretty much it did in the 1970s when Nixon and visited China. We had the rapprochement. China became a part of the world economy. We need something similar, but the terms are different, and I don't know what kind of shape that new rapprochement would take. But I think that when it comes to global security and when it comes to the very real threat of Russia, it is imperative that the U.S. finds a new deal with China to control Russia.
Moving on to another crisis more close to China, which is the South China Sea crisis, how do you think the escalation, a future escalation, would impact the global economy? Keeping in mind, of course, that Taiwan and China relations are tense, and Taiwan is one of the biggest economic allies to the U.S.
The issue of Taiwan, you very correctly pointed out, is the one single issue that China is clearly willing to go to war if needed. For that reason, there is always the fear that we will have some sort of confrontation because of Taiwan, because of the Taiwan issue, and then this will lead to a broader, possibly global kind of escalation. But at the same time, the solution to that problem is the status quo. So right now, we have a Taiwan, which is de facto a free, democratic, socially very progressive, technologically very advanced country. It's a de facto nation. But it's not a de jure, a recognized nation. That's why we cannot have formal diplomatic relations with Taiwan. At the same time, Taiwan, of course, is under the protection of the U.S., and the U.S. needs Taiwan because it's the centerpiece of its security system in East Asia. On the other side, of course, from China's point of view, Taiwan has a huge political symbolism for China. The reunification, as they call it, with Taiwan is considered to be the last act of China's rise. So China cannot really rise symbolically, but also, I would say, strategically without Taiwan. And of course, this is connected to Chinese nationalism, but also to China's geostrategic issues. That's why we see clear kind of black and white approach. Both sides need Taiwan. Both sides are very committed to Taiwan, and President Biden has expressed his support for the status quo many times. But it's also, the status quo sometimes is extremely difficult to keep, because when you have posturing from either side, especially something happens, like an American politician visits unofficially Taiwan, then this becomes a huge issue for China's domestic kind of audience and for nationalism. And then you have military exercises of China. So we see that repertoire of escalation again and again. So retaining the status quo will be extremely difficult, but I think the key to peace in the Taiwan Straits is that the U.S. will maintain its commitment to Taiwan's de facto independence and the de facto protection of its democracy.
As we think of our world today, we think of our communications means through social media, and TikTok is one of the biggest social media globally. How do you think TikTok's influence impacted the trade war between the US and China?
So a technology specialist would tell you that, yes, there are security parameters here that we need to take into consideration. Definitely, any kind of digital technology can be hacked and can be used by foreign powers. We know that very well also in Greece. And then there is also the legal aspect to it, the fact that the Chinese state actually passed a law in the mid-2010s that states that all digital companies essentially need to share information with the Chinese state. So from a technological point of view and a legal point of view, yes, there are definitely issues there. But I think above everything, TikTok has come to symbolize American insecurity vis-a-vis China in a way similar to that of Huawei, because I think it was Huawei during the 2015-2016 that was the big threat. Now it's TikTok. Both Huawei and TikTok are the symbols of the China threat in the US and in Europe. I'm not saying that this is just a paranoia. Absolutely not. There are clear technological security issues there. There are clear problems with, in terms of potential spying activities by the Chinese state. And for that reason, this issue has become so controversial.
We have discussed Chinese military power and strategic alliances, as well as the U.S., how do you think China's soft power is in work around the world? How do Chinese institutions and the collaborations with Western universities reflect their strategic goals?
Yes, this is an area that I'm very personally concerned about, because when we look at the big picture, the biggest challenge is that Western democracies and China have a fundamental difference. In the West, academic freedom, at least in theory, constitutes the core of the existence of universities, right? Academic freedom is so important as a value and in terms of practice, because it allows, it's constitutionally protected, right? It's protected by law, and it allows an academic to do their work, to research whatever they want to research for the benefit of science, for the benefit of society. In China, we do not have academic freedom. So all universities are deeply penetrated structurally by party committees. Now, back in the 2000s, those party committees had atrophied. They were not that active, but actually in the last 10 years or so, we see that party committees within universities, within Chinese universities, are very active. I will refer to the example of Confucius Institutes here, because it's an important one. Confucius Institutes are educational organizations by the Chinese state. They belong to the Chinese state. And their business model has been that they operate within universities. So it's not like the British Council, say, or the Goethe Institute, or the French, the Spanish equivalents, that they are separate entities within countries, right? What we have with Confucius Institutes is that they operate within universities. Again, back in the 2000s, when politically things were way more relaxed, there were not that many problems with their operation. However, in the last decade, we have had issues with Confucius Institutes spying upon students and academics. We have had issues of espionage in terms of research, and this is quite problematic.
So we are at war, obviously, from our discussion, a trade war and beyond. And as we close this discussion, as we conclude, I just want to ask you, do you think we can see a winner in this war?
Well, I think there are two ways to look at it. One way is to say, no, there is no winner. There is only one loser, and the loser is global capitalism. So the world economy, the moment when it needs more growth because of this trade war, it faces many problems. On the other hand, we could say that this is, as it is a part of a big kind of competition between China and the US, this trade war might contribute to the outcome of this war. Because I hear very often from colleagues saying that this is the new status quo, essentially. This is the new situation. But I'm just wondering, for how long can we be in that state? Will there be a winner at some point? And if there is a clear winner, so the US or China, definitely this trade war will have contributed to that win or to that loss.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me and for well-thought questions.
Mixed and sound design by Aris Athanasopoulos. Produced by Panagiotis Menegos. You can listen to more podcasts by visiting podcast.imed.org.